start?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Tina, I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is May 27th of 99. My home group is Papago 12 Steps and 12 Traditions in Phoenix, Arizona. And grateful to be here. And this was kind of a surprise. Bandon asked me this morning if I could speak on the finance panel. And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. And what I was thinking he was asking me is, since I've been sober, I've been involved in general service a lot, and I served as treasurer for my home group, and I served as treasurer for the area, and served as treasurer on some roundup committees, and so I thought he wanted me to talk about, you know, AA finance panels and that sort of thing. And he's like, I get here, and he's like, oh, no, we want to talk about, like, personal finance and sobriety. And it's like, oh. So we're going to wing it. I got to start out by saying, I could have been a young person in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was introduced to AA when I was about maybe 21. And I walked into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked around at you people, and I listened to you people, and I'm like, oh, I'm not that bad. I don't need to be here. And that was my attitude for another, I don't know, like 15 years. I was 36 when I finally got sober. And when I did finally get sober, my finances were not good. I'd had a few DUIs, and I'd had a lot of legal fees, and I'd had a lot of trouble keeping jobs. I can't tell you over the years how many times I quit, I got fired, or I quit right before I got fired because I knew it was coming. And I wasn't a very good employee, and I couldn't really figure out what was going on because, you know, I had in my mind somehow, you know, we have these illusions about ourselves and who we think we are. And I had this idea that, you know, by the time I, you know, was this age, I should be on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and I should have a big mansion, and I should, you know, be driving a Bugatti, and I just couldn't figure out, like, what was wrong, because when I finally got sober, I put myself in a halfway house. And when I say that, it's not that, oh, I made the decision that this would be a good idea. It was like I'd run out of options. I was about to get kicked. I was temporarily living with my parents, 36 years old. I'm about to get fired from my minimum wage job that I had descended to. That was about the only thing I was capable of doing at that time. And so it wasn't like I had a lot of choices. So I ended up putting myself in this halfway house. And I remembered when I moved in there, the rent was $90 a week. And by the time I paid that $90 to get in there, I had like $20 left to my name. And I was working this minimum wage job. I'd been a restaurant manager for a lot of years and made a lot of money, but I kept going through jobs and going through jobs. And every time I got a new job, it wasn't like I was getting a better one, right? They were kind of going downhill. And I was working for a minimum wage. And they had me working as a cashier, and I wasn't working out really well at that. And I ended up working in a bakery, but they didn't even trust me to bake. I was putting things in containers, like I was putting cookies in boxes, and I was putting rolls in bags. And this is kind of funny. I did pretty well with a lot of the things when I first got sober, but in my first 30 days, I couldn't think, and I couldn't stay focused on much of anything. And one of my jobs was to put the rolls in the bags, and we had bags of 6 that I did well with, and we had bags of 12 that I did well with, but we had these bags of 24. And it was really difficult for me to stay focused long enough to count to 24 to put the rolls in the bags. And I get to the end of the rack and I'd have like 2 left over. It's like, oh my God, where do they belong? And I have to go back and figure out where they went because I couldn't count to 24. The reason I mention that, it's really funny, is because in my job today, most people know that I drink. Some people know that I'm in the program. Some people know a lot about me. I work in the finance department of my job, and I don't think they would appreciate the fact that 15 years ago I couldn't count to 24. Might not look too good, but anyhow. So when I got sober, you know, I wasn't in a really good place, but I still had those old ideas, you know, and one of the things that we hear in the meetings when we read how it works, you know, some of us try to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. And some of those old ideas I had about money was that, you know, money was power and money was glamour and money was freedom. And if I had money, everything would be okay, right? And I really had to let go of that because that can't be the basis of my life, is money or power or things that are outside. You know, my happiness, my purpose in life has to come from my higher power. It has to come from living by spiritual principles. And I have to let go of that idea of money. I have to let go of that attachment to money, along with a lot of other things like relationships and power and influence and image and all that stuff, you know. And for a long time, that was my program for happiness, was, you know, if I got this, I'll be happy. If I have enough of this, I'll be happy. And that doesn't work. You know, what I'm learning today, and everything I know about anything in life, including my finances, I've learned through the principles of this program and a lot through the traditions. And what I'm learning today is that my financial security, how, quote, successful I am with finances, is kind of a side effect of how I live my life in other ways. It's not the goal. When I try to make it the goal, I screw it up. You know, but when I do other things right, that kind of seems to take care of itself. You know, when I live by spiritual principles, you know, my relationships with other people seem to work better. My ability to function in the world seems to get better. My relationship with my husband gets better. You know, when I stick to those spiritual principles, everything else falls into place. And I look back, you know, today, you know, life is pretty good and I have money in the bank and stuff like that. But, you know, not that money is a bad thing, but what I've noticed is, you know, with money comes a lot of other things. You start having to worry about your money and having to manage your money and do I have enough money. And when I first got sober, when I was living in that halfway house that I ended up staying at for 2 years, I remember after I'd been sober for a while and I'd worked my steps and things were starting to settle down, I remember one time thinking that, wow, you know, I still don't have any money and I still have that minimum wage job. And I was looking at a prison sentence and I knew it was coming. I just didn't know when. I still had all these things over hanging over my head. But, you know, life was really simple then and it was really pretty happy and pretty trouble-free. You know, sometimes I miss that. It was a lot simpler. But money's not a bad thing. You know, in life, and in AA, you know, you think about with AA as a whole, you know, in order to operate and in order to carry the message, you know, we have to have money. We have to be self-supporting. To be able to go to a meeting, you know, I have to have a couple of bucks to at least get on the bus or to help somebody out with gas if they're taking me to the meetings all the time. You know, we do a lot of work. I currently serve as the corrections coordinator for the area. It takes money to get literature into those facilities. It takes money to get the pamphlets. So money's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a matter of, you know, who's ruling who. Am I managing my own life and using money to help me do the right thing? Or is money ruling my life? And that's where it gets a little, I have to get real honest with myself about where I'm at with my finances and where I'm at with, you know, who's controlling who. You know, in the promises, it says, I love the way things are worded, in our literature and especially in the promises. It says fear of economic insecurity will leave us. Fear of economic insecurity will leave us. It does not say economic insecurity will leave us. It does not say we will never have money problems again. That's not what the promise says. It says fear of economic insecurity will leave us. And that's, I think, a lot of that, you know, who's controlling who thing. You know, if my money is controlling me, or if my quest for power is controlling me, if any of those things are controlling me, there's fear behind that. Because suddenly I'm afraid of not having enough, or not getting what I deserve, or you're making more money than me, or I'm afraid of losing what I have. You know, what if I have, what if I lose my job? What am I going to do? What if I lose this? You know, when I'm allowing that attachment to my finances, that attachment to money, to control my life, rather than turning my will and my life over to higher power and letting my God rule my life, there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of anxiety behind that. You know, another area that finances tend to be a problem with is in relationships. I've been in, before I got sober, I was in a lot of relationships. Some good, some not so good, some really, really stinking horrible. And a lot of the problems in those relationships was money. And a lot of it was about that attachment to money. Because let me tell you, before I got sober in those relationships I was in, we did not live by spiritual principles. And there was a lot of dishonesty behind the money. How much money do you have? Oh, I don't have any. How much do you have? Well, I don't have any. We've both got money stashed. Or lying about what we were spending our money on, not being on the same page about how we were going to spend our money, and in a lot of cases, not being self-supporting. You know, that seventh tradition is so applicable to how we manage our own finances. You know, I have to be fully self-supporting. I can't be counting on you to take care of me. You know, I need to grow up and put my big girl panties on and get a job and pay my bills and be responsible. And Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to do that. I didn't learn how to do that in college. I didn't learn how to do that from my parents. I learned that from you people in here, and I learned it from my home group, and I learned from the mistakes that we make. You know, that reliance on money, I know I'm all over the place, but I'm not prepared. That's okay. That reliance on money, you know, when we place our reliance on things material rather than on our higher power, rather than on spiritual principles, it causes a lot of problems in relationships with other people too. You know, it does in a marriage, it does in a business, and it does in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can think back to some examples of, I remember when I was at GSR, Maricopa County, and this was back in 2004, I think. We had a little bit too much money. We had an extra about $1,000. And for that whole rotation, for 2 years, at every Maricopa County service meeting, everybody had their ideas about how we should spend that money. And, you know, one of the weird things in Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear, if any of you have ever been to an area assembly or business meeting or anything like that, people get kind of heated, you know, and there's some, like, not-so-loving discussion going on sometimes. And one of our past delegates put it in a really good way. He says, you know, we all want what's best for AA, or we all want what's best for our home group. We just have different ideas on what that should be. And so we go into these meetings, and we had this extra $1,000 or whatever it was, and somebody thought it should go to fund GSRs for PRASA, and somebody thought we should donate it to contribute it to GSO, and somebody thought we should buy big books for corrections, and you know, all this discussion, and we argued for 2 years, and finally the money was just kind of gone, and it was over. But it was, you know, there was so much divisiveness over having too much money. You know, and that's one of the cool things about that corporate poverty that's part of our structure in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen the other side of it too. In one of my home groups, we were struggling financially, and we were having to come up with ways of, you know, how are we going to pay our rent? How are we going to fund our GSR? How are we going to do these things? And it was really cool because our home group all of a sudden came together because we had to figure stuff out. And it was really a neat example of how that works. And we got through it, and God took care of us, and we took care of ourselves, and we were self-supporting. And it was a really neat thing to watch, you know, how the difference between that having too much money and being too attached to it and worrying about how we're going to spend it versus we have barely enough and we need to rely on each other and we need to rely on God. You know, it was really a good lesson for me. The last thing I'm going to say when it comes to finance in AA, and this is something I've learned from some of our some of our elder statesmen in AA. I came in, especially when I was serving as the area treasurer, and I was hung up on the money aspect of Seventh Tradition. And we both presented at a workshop, and he says, you talk about the money and what the treasurer does in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to talk about something else that has to do with the Seventh Tradition. And what he talked about was participation and how we have to be self-supporting in other ways than just the finances. You know, if we had home groups that had so much money that we could pay a greeter and we could pay somebody to make our coffee and we could pay somebody to do setup and cleanup and well, we used to clean ashtrays, but we don't do that anymore. You know, how spiritual would our group be? How much would we be reliant on God and on each other if we just paid for everything? Where would AA be if we had to manage money and we had to pay all these professionals and we didn't rely on each other to take care of us? I think there's an important lesson in that. And that's enough out of me, and I'm going to pass it to Alex.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tina. I'm Alex. I'm an alcoholic.
Alex.
I was asked by a good friend of mine who's on the committee to speak on this panel. And I asked him why, and he said to me, well, you like money, and you always have it, and, you know, I didn't think I was qualified. So I guess, you know, the best way I could think of doing it is kind of tell you guys my story and how finances have played a part into my life until now. Is from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I come from middle-class family. My parents never really had all that much money, but I never was really worried, you know, about it. I didn't really want for anything my whole life. I just, you know, the heat was always on, food was always in the fridge. Pretty much always had new clothes, you know. So that's what I expected, you know. I got sober when I was 18, first time around. And I've been in AA since, for the last 8 years. And I didn't really have any kind of career before that. I worked at like Ace Hardware. I did concrete. I made minimum wage, you know. I made pretty good money for being, 14 through 18. But pretty much, how I funded my drinking and using career is I stole, you know. I stole from my family. I robbed whatever I could. I stole from stores, and I spent my whole paycheck. So getting sober at 18, I had no idea how to manage my finances whatsoever. No one had ever really taught me. I didn't ever have to pay rent before. And I moved here. I moved to Prescott in 2006, and I went to this program called New Freedom. And my current sponsor was running it at the time. And basically what you were supposed to do in this house was your parents could pay for the first month, and then you were on your own. So we had to hit the pavement, go on job search, find a job, and then after, you know, the first 4 weeks, you had to pay $125 a week, and you were responsible for all your food. And he was like, You're going to learn how to do this, you know. And if you got any help from family whatsoever, you were booted out. It was like pretty black and white. You know, so what I did is I didn't ask for help. I got a sponsor. I didn't really work with the sponsor much for the first 4 months. I relapsed in that time. I got kicked out in that time. When I got kicked out of this place, I was over $500 behind on rent. I was homeless in the middle of the desert in Prescott, Arizona. I had like $125 to my name that I got from working at this car wash. And I did what all I knew to do, which was call mom and try to convince mom to get me a bus ticket and whatnot. And something happened to me then. It's a big part of my story. Is a young guy who graduated this program named Simon. He came and he just said, you don't have to go, dude. You don't have to go do what you're going to do, because I plan on getting high. drunk. I had a bus, manipulated my mom to get me a bus ticket home, give me some money. And he just said, you don't have to go. And I believed this guy. I believed in him. You know, he was a second step for me. And I said, no. And I called my mom and I said, no, I don't want any help. And then I had some good, mentors in the program, called my mom and gave her a little talking to and said that if she gives me money, I'm going to die. And I've since been able to do that for a lot of people, for a lot of people's parents. So anyway, I'm homeless in Prescott for about a week. I'm staying on people's couches, going to meetings. I'm working, and they invite me to come back into this house. And I really didn't know why, because I had done so much harm. But they invited me back in because they saw that I was, like, showing up, doing recovery, that something had changed. So the stipulation after about 3 days of them, and I was gone for about a week, about 3 days they let me come back each day, and they just fucking drilled me in this thing called Circle. And they were just like, if you're going to come back in, you know, I mean, they just took my inventory hard. But basically the stipulations were if I came back in, you know, I had to get a sponsor, work the steps. If I did any bullshit, I talked to any girls, anything like that, it was just no questions asked, you're out. But one of the stipulations was I had to stay on a couch until my rent was paid. And it was $125 a week on top of that $500 every week till that was paid. So what I did is I worked at a car wash. I gave them every check every week, and I gave them half of my tips every week. And I learned, you know, I was able to survive. All I needed was a little bit of food and a pack of cigarettes back then. And kind of like you were saying, you know, it was so easy back then. It was like, it was the hard, you know, I thought it was the hardest thing I ever did. Which, yeah, back then, absolutely, it was. You know, getting sober, there's nothing like it. But, you know, that was just it. I just had to worry about food, cigarettes, and have kids, nothing like that. So anyway, I learned some responsibility. I worked to my ninth step, and I started making amends. And what I started making amends is I started making amends to guys in this program. I would steal their food all the time. And what I started doing is I started paying them back and telling them that I wasn't going to do that anymore. I started making financial amends, and that fear of economic insecurity had left me, you know. So anyway, I graduated from this program, move on. Life's good. But I kind of fell back, you know. I had never lived on my own before. I didn't really talk too much about my sponsor, about finances. I paid my rent and all, but I was still asking my mom for help probably every 3 to 4 months. She was still paying for my cell phone bill, and this was probably until I was about 2 years sober. And something happened in about that time. I was working at the hospital. I had a good job. I was making pretty good money for being 20 years old. I was in school. And I decided, you know, I was sitting with my sponsor. The one thing that was missing out of my program was making financial amends, you know, and learning to be 100% fully self-supporting. You know, so I basically cut my mom off from helping me. You know, I was like, no more. Please don't buy me anything anymore. Like, I can't do it. This is the one thing I need to address that I've lacked on. And a cool thing that I got to do was, I got to go home, and instead of my mom, me being on my mom's cell phone bill, I put her on my, I started my own account and put her on my own cell phone bill. And I did that for about 2 years until, I got married. You know, so little pieces of, financial stability, I guess there, started happening for me. So moving on, I guess, I started learning to manage my money better. I didn't learn from this program to start, like, how to be financially stable, how to be financially secure. I really learned by fucking it all up and being broke or having no food, or my mom, you know, my mom would get pissed at me when I'd ask her for money. She'd be like, what the hell are you doing? You know, you work at the hospital. You know, you got a good job. But I learned through, like, pain, you know, and then I would ask. And then I would be like, okay, something is moving me to take some action. So life moves on. I meet my wife, who's my wife today. We fall in love, and we get pregnant. And at this time that That recovery home that I was talking about that I went through, I took over it about a year before from my mentor, my sponsor. And at the time, my partner and I, who was an alumni of this program, we took it over and I quit working at the hospital. I like put all in to this thing, hoping that it was going to work. And you talk about, you know, you talked about financial insecurity or whatever in relationships. That was rough, you know. I was making about $200 a month with this little one on the way, and just struggling, not knowing what I was going to do. You know, I had saved up some money. You know, we were just getting by on our bills. And I mean, we had reached the bottom where I was fighting with my wife all the time about it. You know, I was pissed at her for buying this, and then I'd go buy a pair of shoes, you know. And it was tough times, you know. And you know, fortunately, you know, the only reason that kind of the insecurity left me is because my program got big, and my business became successful. It wasn't like any work I did that I got more secure. What kind of happened was shit stuff started working out for me. You know, I have no problem in my financial life or my sex life when everything's going my way. You know, like shit's going my way, we're all good. You know, and what happened is this business started being successful, and I started a treatment center, and I took over a women's home, and you know, now today I started a treatment center in Milwaukee. You know, and like I get to do what I love, and I can provide for my family. You know, and in that time in 2011 was when this little one was on the way, and a couple different things happened that I want to share with you. Is I watched this movie called The Boiler Room. And in this part in the movie, and I fully believed it because I was scared at the time. I was very scared. You know, I was so insecure and I didn't want to ask my family again for help. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I think Ben Affleck says it, and he says something like, anybody who says money doesn't buy happiness never fucking had any. And I was like, God, he's so right. You know, like he's so right. If I just had like a couple grand in the bank, bills were paid, if I could just save up, you know, be ahead on the cell phone bill, be ahead on all that, I was like, man, then I'll be good, you know, then I'll be good, like, and I went with that for probably about a year, you know, even when I was started making money to provide for my family. And then what I noticed started happening in my life was, every year I'd say, next year I want to be here. Next year I want to make this amount of money. Next year I want to make this a month. And I would get there. And then I'd fucking be miserable. You know, I'd be like, damn, if I could just make double that, then we'd be really floating, you know? If I had this vehicle and then start that business and have this investment account, you know, I'd be like, then we're going to be good, you know? And I've done all that. And I still, like, had been in the middle of that for a while. Even with kids, you know, like, diapers are expensive, you know, after a while. I got three daughters now. I got three daughters, a wife, and I'm the only one that works. And I put a lot of pressure on myself, you know. I do. I drive myself insane at times financially. But what I discovered in that is, like, it's I'm never going to be happy with it. I'm, like, always going to want more. And my sponsor told me, you know, we were talking, he was like, everybody was saying, oh, money's the root of all evil. No, it's not. It's like the want for money is the root of all evil. You know, the vanity in it. And that's the stuff I started to be able to work on. Is like, since I've been in this program, I got to ask myself, when have I not been taken care of, you know? In like 8 years. I had 3.5 years sober. I went out, and I was still taken care of. Everybody waited for me when I came back. You know, I've been taken care of since then. As long as I continue showing up, you know, and then another thing happened at that time. I started sponsoring probably one of the most influential guys that I've ever sponsored on in my life. He was in his 30s, and I was in my 20s. He's about 10 years older than me. And he went into this other program that I was really close with in town. He asked me to sponsor him. You know, we knew each other through mutual friends. And I saw him in this program broke. The whole time, like he was in the same kind of program where you had to pay rent every week, Well, the thing was, he was working at True Value, and his entire check was getting taken every week or every 2 weeks because he had child support. And I kept talking to him about, you know, having a kid, and he had kids, and I kept talking about him wanting to get married and all this insecurity. And he had told me that he was making about 300 to 400 grand a year for a long time. And he said he had every fucking toy he ever wanted. He had every big house. He had girls. He had money, property, and prestige. But he said he told me he was happier being in this program, getting his entire check taken, than he had ever been his whole life. And that completely fucking turned my world upside down, you know? And this guy has been kind of, you know, I sponsored him. He has no idea how much he's helped me with. He's the reason that I was pulled the trigger on most of the big commitments I have in my whole life. I didn't want to get married because I was scared financially. He was like, dude, everything's going to be okay. He's like, just pop the question, you know? And everything has been okay. And so I've kind of stuck by that, you know, and I lost that whole boiler room thing. But today financially I'm successful. I guess I know today, like, money, property, and prestige, they completely divert us from our primary purpose. I've been so instilled in how I'm going to provide for my family and how I'm going to, you know, have their college paid for and this and that, and how I'm going to make sure that I'm going to have the bills paid for the next 6 months so I have, like, a reserve if shit goes south, that I've completely lost sight of my program at times, you know. I have, you know, I go to my meetings, you know, I have a home group in town, I'm the treasurer of that meeting, I've been taught the business of A, but I'll just be there, like, showing up, thinking, stressing about the future, you know, stressing, like, okay, we're doing good now, but how are we going to be doing next year, you know. But when I live in today, you know, usually everything's pretty good. It's kind of funny. When Askipaw was in Prescott in 2009, I spoke on the romance panel, the relationship panel. And my sponsor always taught me, said, young people, finance and romance. It's like, that's going to be the things that will take you out. Or it'll be, you know, things that they'll be the biggest gifts in. It'll be the hardest struggles, and that's true. In 2009, when I spoke on the relationship panel, I was in the darkest spot of my recovery that I had ever been in. I was in a sick relationship, and I was like, why are they asking me to speak? You know, I was like, I was just miserable, you know. And then 5 years later, I'm not miserable today, you know. But it's just funny, you know, 5 years later, my romantic life is healthy, it's good, I've worked on it, and I'm in the middle of, figuring out what works and what doesn't. I don't believe in good and bad, right and wrong. My 7-step prayer is not, God, I'm ready for you to have all of me, good and bad. I don't say that. I say, I'm ready for you to have all of me, what works and what doesn't. In regards to my financial life, that's kind of where I'm at, you know. I get real, like, way out there with it. And I was talking to some people the other night, and I was thinking, you know, like, stressing about money, and that's probably been the biggest stress I've had over the last year or two. And I was like, damn, like, do I want to be on, like, my deathbed, you know, like thinking that I obsessed so much of my life about fucking green paper. That's, like, all it is. You know what I mean? Like, in this little span in time of my maybe 70 to 80 years I'm going to live, hopefully, you know, and I'm this little speck in this big universe, and I want to say that the significance of my life was, like, stressed about green fucking paper that can just burn and it's gone. You know, like, that really hit home for me. You know, I was talking to some people about it, and I was like, that's not what I want, how I want to live my life, you know. It's not the quality, you know, I want. So yeah, I'm really grateful to have been able to share here today, and thank you guys for all showing up. Thank you.
Thanks, Alex. Does anyone have any questions or comments for Tina or Alex?
Come on.
Joe Alcoholic. Joe. I just can't stand the silence, so. No, first of all, thank you both for sharing. You know, it was just good to hear your stories. And I agree, you know, romance and finance, you know, that's why a good portion of that 14 to 12 is dedicated to it. Those are two places I know as an alcoholic that I whack out after I take alcohol out of the picture, you know. Different ways that my disease manifests itself, you know, is in those areas, not manageability. I guess the question I have for you is, it's surrounding financial events, you know, and I just kind of want to hear more about your process that you went through during financial events. I don't know if you had to do those. I know I did because I was just a thief, you know. That's just how I am. But if you have any experience or insight into that, different tools that you use to learn how to budget that money in to take care of those things, that would be beneficial.
Tina, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't have a huge amount of financial amends when I came in. Probably because for a really, really long time I was making less and less and less money and I was spending less and less and less money. So there weren't a lot, but what I did have were, I had a credit card debt and I had to discipline myself to set aside X amount of money, that was going to go towards that and really discipline myself to do that. And I had my sponsor holding me accountable to that. She would ask me, because we shared that as part of the fourth step and part of the fifth, you know, let me see your budget and what you plan to do, you know, in the future. And then part of the ninth step was, Tina, are you following through with what we talked about in step five? And she would hold me accountable. Another part of it, where I really owed the most, part of it was financial, part of it was... a lot of it was financial. It was with my parents. You know, like you talked about, always having to go to your parents. They didn't give me money a lot, but what they did was, you know, I was a horrible daughter for years and years and years. And what I would do was I would disappear. I wouldn't even talk to them for like months at a time until I ran myself into the ground financially and had no place to go, and they would have to bail me out. And I would spend, you know, 6 months, 2 months, 4 months with them supporting me. They didn't hand me money, but they were buying my food. I was sleeping, you know, either on their couch or in one of their bedrooms or whatever, you know, whatever the situation was at the time. And I never offered to pay for anything. Not that they needed it, but I was not accountable for myself. And at the time, I was not willing. I was so selfish and self-centered, it didn't even occur to me that, gee, you should be paying your mom rent. You should be paying your dad for the times he let you borrow the car and you didn't put any gas in it. And so when I was wanting to make amends to my parents for all of that, I couldn't really quantify how much money I owed them. They didn't really need any money from me. But what my sponsor suggested, she said, you know, come up with an amount, make the offer to them, and they wouldn't have anything of that. But what they really wanted was more of my time. They wanted to see me. They wanted a daughter that I had never been. And so I agreed with them that, you know, I would come over, at the time it was every Tuesday night. I picked a night that, you know, worked for both of us. And I would spend time with them at least once a week. And, you know, at first, here I am, you know, I've had a resentment with my parents for a long time, and this was really uncomfortable because we didn't really even know each other anymore. And I really didn't want to do it, but, you know, I said I would, and so, you know, I did. That was almost 15 years ago. I still go visit my parents every weekend. It's a living amends that I make today, and I'm grateful, and I'm bummed. Now I go because I want to go. I don't go because I told my sponsor I would. That was one of those amends that it should have been a financial amends. My parents wouldn't have anything to do with that, so I had to do it in another way because I couldn't just let it go, right? Those were my big ones. And, you know, it was about learning how to just be responsible and how to grow up and how to not use people. I heard something recently, trust God, love people, use things and money, and never get those mixed up. And that's something I really have to pay attention to because it's really easy to get those kind of warped. But that's all I have.
Thank you.
Elks alcoholic. Yeah, you know, I kind of like I said in my story, it took me a bit before I really made some financial amends. It was usually here or there, $20, you know, to old friends that I stole from. But, you know, I guess what I was taught then was to do, when I really started diving into it, was just a little bit every month. So every month I was making some kind of financial amends. I'm always, like today I'm always working on my ninth step, I say. Because like every month, sometimes every week, I'm like sending money here, but I guess what, kind of like I said in my story, it's easy when like things are going my way. Like, oh, if I got the money, then it's like easier to send it. When I'm like struggling financially or I'm being selfish, I haven't really made any at times, you know? But kind of like the little things, I guess the way that I do it is, my family's pretty stubborn. You know, I stole from them the most. They don't want to take my money. You know, I've convinced my mom to start cashing my checks, that I send. I've convinced my uncle to start doing it. And they'll do it, but other than that, like, kind of the way I do it is my mom comes into town, she stays with me and my kids, and she doesn't pay for anything, you know? Like, she's got her own room, I pay for all the groceries, I pay for her bottle of wine, I pay for everything, you know? Like, she doesn't pay for shit. That's the same thing when I take my family, when I go out to dinner with them, I pay for it. I guess the thing too that I got this year is I was really against paying back. I stole from a lot of drug dealers. I robbed a lot of drug addicts too, you know. And I was really against paying them back. I was like, no way, like that's doing harm, blah, blah. But then the clarity that I got to in this last year was that, if I'm back in Milwaukee and I'm like out to eat with my wife and kids and that guy walks in, I'm not free. You know, like he knows that I owe him money and I'm putting my wife and kids like in danger if he's like still pissed, you know? So anytime I see anybody like that, I'll pay back drug dealers because I want to be free. I want to be able to walk this earth, be anywhere and pay that back. So, little things like that, like I've had guys, that I stole from, you know, walk past me in the mall and be like, you got that $40? Like 3 years later, I'm like, yup, here, dude, you know, hopefully get to have a conversation with him. But, I try to do a little bit every month, big stores, stuff like that. Like I stole a lot from this Ace Hardware that I worked at. They like absolutely refused to take the money because they didn't like know how to put it in their accounting, you know? So I didn't really know what to do with that other than I've been told, like, go buy something and put it back, you know, or buy, scan it twice and pay for it or something, you know. I've done little things like that over the years. I don't know. I try to have fun with it. I try to play with it, you know. Like, as long as I'm doing a little bit to the big ones, you know, I owe my mom probably, like, $50,000, you know, just for rehab, like, everything over the years, you know, paying for a car for me, like, whatever. And I owe my uncle probably, you know. There's a lot of money out there, okay? And I'm paying a little bit every month. Okay.
Bryce, Dragag.
Hey, Bryce.
So I've got some deals worked out with, like, you know, I owe a bunch of financial amounts all over. And I have a lot of things set up where it automatically comes out and everything's good. But I have one, I mean, we're just kind of talking about amends, and I apologize for being late, I only talked the last story. But I got one amends that's pretty major. I used to work at a bar. Literally, like, I've tried to sit down and come up a number. What do you do with something 4 years, and I would just give away shots for drugs and take money out of the tip jar and take money out of the cash register? Like, trying to come up with even a rough estimate would be a really poor effort, you know what I mean? Because I was pretty much blacked out the whole time. If you guys have any suggestions for a situation like that, I've talked about it with one of my sponsors. I haven't talked about it with my newest sponsor. So obviously,
I'm Tina, I'm an alcoholic. Is it the same owner or manager that's still there?
Yeah.
One thing you might do, and again, run this by your sponsor, you might see if you can set up an appointment to talk to that guy and explain to him what you would like to do and that you don't have an amount and what you are able to pay. Like, you know, if you're able right now to pay, like, you know, $20 a week or $20 a month or, you know, and talk to him and get his feedback. He may have an idea how much you stole. He may not. But I think, you know, you're demonstrating that you're willing to make those amends and willing to do whatever it takes to where you, it's about amending the relationship more than anything, you know, and feeling like you've owned up to your part. You know, if he tells you, you know, hey, I have no idea, I had no idea you were even stealing, but if you feel that's what you need to do, you know, what can you pay me? Can it be $100 a month for the next year? Or, you know, whatever he suggests that's reasonable, and just kind of see where that goes. If he says, no, I won't take anything, you know, I don't know where to put it in my accounting, I don't have a line item for other income on my income statement. You know, one of the things that was suggested to me, too, because I didn't share this in my story, but over the years when I was drinking, I lost count after 40 moves. I did a lot of geographics. I had wreckage from coast to coast. And I had a hard time remembering who I might have used for something. And, you know, I didn't rob people or anything, but, you know, I mistreated people. And, you know, sometimes there was some financial stuff there. I don't even remember their name or what state they were in. I just know that, you know, I remember this guy and I did him wrong. In situations like that where you can't make the financial amends directly, what was suggested to me was when there's an event like the upcoming state convention, I can buy scholarships. You know, I can buy $100 worth of scholarships for somebody, or I can make a donation to Alcoholics Anonymous, or I can go, I can donate to a charity, or, you know, whatever, if it's not possible to do it directly. So just some thoughts.
Alcoholics. I agree with everything she said. I think those are great ideas. Most of mine, I just came up with a number and then I added a couple grand, you know. That's really what I did. You know, I put an average to it, you know, and I was like, that much per day or per week, and then I just added some more, you know.
Is that kind of like the I only had two beers thing?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, like my eighth step, I've rewritten it so many times, dude. Like, I've added shit, like, I think just a couple weeks ago, I have it on my computer, and I was like, damn, that's another $1,000 I owe mom. I was like remembering that, and I like put that down, you know. So I think you just make a start, man. Like, I got a guy right now who owes me financial amends, and I'm not keeping track. I'm like, dude, you keep track, you know, I'm not keeping track of what you paid me. He gives me like $20 a week, and he's like, I just figure I'm just gonna give this to you forever. And I'm like, okay, dude, you know, whatever he's got to do, you know, and eventually, like, I got a story from, one of my best friends. He was making financial amends to his grandparents for a long time, and in every week he'd send, a check and he'd send a letter. And he did it for a couple years, and finally his grandparents were like, listen, you can stop with the checks, but just don't stop sending the letters, you know? Like, that's what they really cared about. So I just say, you know, go up to the guy, ask him what he thinks, tell him the harm, tell him what you did, tell him what the harm was, and come up with your best estimate. I think the point is that you're willing to do it, dude. That's bigger than anything, you know? That's all I got.
You know, one thing I just want to mention, you know, God has an amazing way of directing. You know, all we have to do is come up with the willingness, and usually God kind of points us in the right direction and makes it possible. My husband was in a situation, sometimes you don't even realize when you're making an amends until, you know, it kind of hits you. My husband, his son got in a car accident, and my husband ended up paying to have the car repaired, and it was quite a few $1,000, and he wasn't real happy about having to do that. But then one day, he had completely forgotten about something that had happened when he was really, really young. My husband got sober at 22. He's here today. But anyway, when he was still drinking and using, he rolled his brother's car, his Camaro, totaled it, destroyed it, and it never occurred to him ever, even in sobriety, even through the whole nine-step process, that he owed his brother an amends for that. It just kind of like slipped his mind. It was his brother, and it was just, you know, they were both using, and just totally slipped his mind, and he realized, oh my God, I'm making an amends now for what I did to my brother's car. You know, I never fixed his car, but now I'm having to fix my son's car. And so he was, you know, it wasn't, you know, he was kind of angry about having to do it until he realized, you know what, I owe this amends. And so he was okay with it after that. So it's amazing what God does for us, whether we want to.
Jake, alcoholic.
Hey, Jake.
I like what you said about, you know, no matter how much money you have, you're always going to want more. You know, for me, you know, in the beginning, when I was still using and drinking, so, you know, I had a decent amount of money. And now, you know, I'm currently in treatment, and I'm trying to rebuild my life. And, you know, I just don't have a clue of how I'm going to rebuild that in a positive way. Because, you know, what I was doing wasn't necessarily legal. So I'm just trying to think of, you know, ways to restart that, you know, because you always have to start from the bottom. And that's hard for me to grasp or comprehend sometimes, you know, because I was just fast easy money. And just, I'd like some advice a little bit on that.
About getting back on your feet?
Yeah, as far as, you know, just starting from the bottom and being able to handle that.
Okay, I'll share with you on that. You know, when I was growing up, we were real middle class, you know, real middle class. And then, you know, as I got out on my own, you know, I had times where I had quite a bit of money coming in. I had times when I had like no money coming in. And you know, when I got sober, like I said, I was pretty broke and in debt and looking at prison. I did end up having to spend a little bit of time in prison, and I got out, and, my expectations were pretty low. You know, I was happy having my little job in the grocery store. And I kind of was in a place of acceptance that, you know, I'm not making any money, and I don't have a car right now, and I don't even have a driver's license, and I'm still living in the halfway house. And then I eventually got an apartment with a gal that I met in the halfway house. And I kind of had resigned myself to the fact that, you know, I'm probably always going to work for kind of a small hourly wage. And you know what? It's okay, because my life is so much better today than it was back when I had money. I remember one of the times that I was married to a man who was pretty successful. We lived in this big house in a really nice neighborhood. I was in a sick, abusive relationship. We were both drinking and using, and I was the most miserable I've ever been in my life. So, you know, I was kind of like okay with the fact that, okay, I'm a minimum wage kind of person. Well, what happened for me, having no expectations, but just learning to live the way you people taught me to live and how to be responsible and show up every day and do my job and be honest and be reliable and whatever. What ended up happening was I was at this grocery store and they needed someone to work with the pricing manager to do data entry. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm pretty fast on the 10-key. I can do that. So I got a raise and I got that job. And then an opportunity came up at our Western Division office. And they gave me that job. And then they had a layoff there, which sounded like a really horrible thing. Well, I ended up going back to the grocery store that I worked at before, but as the dairy manager. So I'm making a little more money. And then I finally decided that, you know, I'm turning 40 and I don't want to be lifting these cases when I'm 60. So maybe I should start looking for a real job. And I'd taken a few college classes. I never did finish my degree, but I'd taken some college classes. And I applied for this job, and this was in 2002. I was 3 years sober, had a felony, and really didn't expect much, okay? And I got hired at my current job in the accounts receivable department. I'm still at an hourly rate, wage, but it's higher. And so little by little by little, things just kind of kept happening. And I didn't have this grand plan, believe me. You know, this was all just putting one foot in front of the other. And today, I'm still at that job. I've been at the same job for 12 years. That's, like, freaking amazing. And, you know, all of these years in the past, when I was a restaurant manager in an earlier life, I had this desire to, like, stomp people down and get to the top, and I was going to be president of the company someday, and I could never get there because I was dishonest. My motives weren't in the right place. I was manipulative and I was a bitch and nobody wanted to work for me. But, you know, just being honest and reliable and living the way you guys have taught me to live, I've advanced with my company
I'm the director of credit and administration. I have an office. I have an expense account. They trust me to travel and shit. I never, ever expected that. So all I have to say is just put it in God's hands, put one foot in front of the other, and you have no idea where you may end up. That's the best advice I can give. Pass.
Yeah, dude, I assume, you know, you being in treatment and all, you probably haven't worked the steps yet or haven't gotten through them. So that's why it ties in. I think get a good sponsor, dude. Work the steps. Do a ninth step. Like, do a real, have a completed A step, do a real ninth step. And what I got from the ninth step is, how free do you want to be? And, like, you don't even, if you're like me, you don't even know what you want right now. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't even know, like, where you're going to be. Where I'm at today, dude, when I first walked in, this was not what I wanted. I did not think I was going to, like, be the director of the program that I went through, you know? Not my plan, dude. You know, like, I know we all started from the bottom, you know?
Below the bottom.
Yeah, below the bottom, you know? And I think you work the steps, dude, and the way, and this is the way I do it, and I'm not saying right or wrong, good or bad, but you work the steps, and I think if you do the right thing for the right reason, a lot of times the things that you want become your recovery. And you got to, don't be confused with that, though. Like, in the book it says we align our will with God's, basically. You know, when we're on this plane, we like can intuitively know. I don't have to ask all the time, it just becomes a part of me. And when I got to my 12th step, and it was kind of like, my sponsor was like, well, Alex, what do you want now? Like, what do you want to do? Like, how good can it get? You know, what could you wake up doing and you're like, I can't fucking believe they pay me to do this? And I pretty much do that today, you know. Not all the time, it's not what I want, you know, it's tough. But I would say that kind of like the alcoholic who fails to grow spiritually is sure to drink again. I apply that to everything in my life. Not just growing spiritually, we're sitting down at a coffee shop working inventory. I'm talking like in my life, at the workplace, at my, with my finance and romance. Like, I'm always, looking to improve my relationship with my wife and my relationships with my close friends. And I'm also always looking to improve my financial life. But the way that I think I can do that is doing the right thing for the right reason. Like, I believe in productivity, in every area of my life and progress. Like, I guess the thing with it, dude, is like learning to be content while you're moving forward. You know, cause like I said, I'm like, oh, I want to be here next year. You know, I want to be here then the next year. It's learning to be content. Like, damn, I'm right here right now. Things are pretty good and I'm going to keep working for what's next. And it's gotten easier and easier for me since I've been sober. If I work those steps, you know, if I keep doing it. So my advice, dude.
When I first got sober and I moved into the halfway house and I got my sponsor, there was this woman that lived there, and she was about 5 years sober, and she was still living in the halfway house, and she had a job, and she had a cat. And she wasn't real happy or anything, and she was kind of frumpy looking and whatever, but she had something that I didn't know that I could ever have. She had 5 years of sobriety, she had a job, and she had a pet. And so one day, Kathy, my sponsor, asked me, she's like, Tina, what do you think you want out of sobriety? What do you think you want your life to look like? And I thought, well, I think I kind of want to be like Susan. I think I want to just stay here and work my job. I hope I can keep my job at the grocery store. And maybe I can get a cat. And, you know, I was excited about that because it was so much better than what I had before. And, you know, I heard people say things in the meetings like, don't sell yourself short. And, you know, if you would have told me, like you were saying, you know, if you'd have told me then that my life would look like what it looks like today, that I would have a happy marriage, I didn't know that really existed, and that I would have a job that I actually wanted to go to, and that they value me, I had no idea that was possible. So, you know, it's just amazing. It's just amazing what this program can do for you. And it's not... One thing, it takes a long time, and it's not a straight, you know, like a straight climb up. I don't know about you, but for me, it wasn't like, oh, we just keep going up and life just keeps getting better and better. There's some ups and downs. You know, in my first year, right before I celebrated my first year, I had to go to prison for what I had done when I was drinking. And I actually celebrated my first birthday in prison. My sponsor sent me a little rubbing of my chip because she couldn't send the actual chip. I still have it. So that was kind of a downer, right? You know, that's kind of a downer in your first year of sobriety. You got to go to prison. Damn, you know, I thought things were supposed to get better, you know. And then I didn't have a driver's license for 3 years. And that kind of sucked, you know, and I had to ride the bus. And then, you know, I had to go back to work at the grocery store, and that seemed like kind of a bummer, but it turned out to be a good thing. A lot of the really challenging things that happen in your sobriety, and even before you get sober, if you look back on them, some of the things that look like they're a roadblock or a bad thing, you know, we don't know what's good or bad. You know, sometimes they turn out to be the most valuable things we have. They turn out to really be blessings. I lost my first sponsor in my fourth year of sobriety. She was killed in a motorcycle accident. God took that and turned it into an amazing thing. It brought a group of women together that are still together today. And I think there was a lot of power in that because she's kind of a guardian angel for all of us now. You know, I have to not be too hung up on what I think the plan is and what I think the path should be. I can have goals and I can have ideals and I can have things that I think I might want later. I just can't get too hung up on them because what I think is good for me may not be what's good for me. God always has a better idea.